You're listening to Radio Area.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon. For the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. For the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. Switch your pike upon your...
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is Thursday, October 3rd, 2019. I'm Andy Donner, and you're listening to Radio Free Northwest.
The blessed warming light, farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Ladies and gentlemen, this week's Radio Free Northwest episode is the fourth and final installment in the Intro to the NF series. You may recall this series was started as a tribute to Harold Covington on the first anniversary of his death. As mentioned, everything we do from here on out needs to serve double duty because we've got to be that much more efficient with our time going forward. It isn't my purpose to make this episode about me, since, again, this is a tribute to Harold Covington in some sense, but I want to call out the date. The 3rd of October is the anniversary of my personal homecoming and the completion of my Northwest migration. This year is the 8th such anniversary. That's somewhat significant because I published a commentary on the same subject 4 years ago. 4 years on, there have been precious few good developments, and to the contrary, a number of very disturbing things have happened. Again, I don't want to sour this episode. I will save those remarks for next week. Please tune in. Even so, I must leave you with this thought. In the material assembled for this week's episode, Harold opines that everyone should pay very close attention and take notes to what he says, because odds are we'll have to do this without him. That might be the most fitting end cap to all of the material in the introduction series. Pay attention to that, though, because the material in which he makes those remarks is probably some of the most important he ever released. And with that, the final installment in the Intro to the NF series. Enjoy.
In last week's broadcast, we talked about the 9-month syndrome, a movement phenomenon where, after about 9 months, our new people get bored because there are no immediate spectacular results, like assassinations or an ongoing revolution, and there's nobody in their area who's willing to meet with them. Anyway, basically, after a few months, a lot of white people with short American attention spans are used to demanding the instant gratification of every desire, get bored with the Northwest idea once they find out it's actually hard to move to the homeland, and they wander away looking for other entertainment. Last week, I asked you guys out there to tell me, honestly and up front, exactly what it is that you want to see from me and from the Northwest Front that will keep you from getting bored. I got some pretty good responses, and this one is from Mark in Illinois. Dear Harold, just finished listening to the most recent podcast. You asked for suggestions as to what you should speak about. I'm very much impressed by your intelligence, but even more so, as compared to Dr. Pierce, by your down-home, folksy, and humorous approach. I chuckle out loud at least once every time I listen to a podcast. You are a rare one of our breed, a creative, artsy white nationalist who, unlike Dr. Pierce, can speak to the common man in our movement. The major takeaway I have from your broadcasts is the need to educate us on what it is like, really, to be a serious-minded political soldier of the European variety, the Irish nationalist, the South African nationalist, etc. You have had direct exposure to these people. We must, as simple-minded, materialistic Americans, learn to become serious political soldiers. Give us, in your podcasts, that sense. Tell us from your direct experience of the men and women you knew in Ireland or South Africa, with your artist's eye, of their methods and mental attitudes. How do we fight for the homeland and deal with our broken and sometimes hostile families, for example? How do we hold down a day job but at night have enough energy and motivation to continue the struggle? Okay, Mark, the obvious answer is that the men I knew in the Rhodesian Army and the people I observed in Ireland from the sidelines back in the 1980s were very much a different kind of white person from white Americans. Most of you people out there honestly have no idea what I'm talking about because you've never yourselves known any other life besides liberal American political correctness. And with all due respect, I honestly don't think most of you really believe that any different kind of world or life is possible. And of course, as long as you believe that, you're right, it isn't possible. First off, the people I knew in Rhodesia and Ireland did share one thing in common with me. We were both born and raised in the last of our respective old ways, the old British Empire way in Africa and the old traditional Catholic Irish way in Ireland. Getting back to the difference between white Africans and Americans, I won't say that they were raised without television, because they did see some, and there were certainly Hollywood movies in their youth, which can be almost as harmful, but certainly not the harmful level of television that exists today. They hadn't had their brains sautéed and pulverized by 6 hours of poisoned YouTube every day. The Irish also grew up poor, probably the poorest white people in the world outside of Appalachia and maybe Mississippi. White people who don't grow up in the lap of luxury don't get anywhere near as corrupted as Americans do. A large part of our American apathy is not just cowardice, but simple laziness due to the incredible level of personal luxury that even to this day we enjoy. You have to have lived in Europe like the Europeans themselves do, like I've done, in bedsitters and council housing estates, to understand just how incredibly rich and luxurious and spacious American life is. You really have no idea just how much material luxury American white people wallow in compared to everyone else in the world, and it doesn't do well for building our character. Secondly, the white Africans and the Irish of, I won't say my generation, but the ones I observed in my time in their countries grew up when important things were still speakable. You could and did actually talk about such things as the facts of race or politics, and it was entirely expected that you would have a partisan point of view. Having opinions to the right of center wasn't the self-destructive heresy it is in this country today. White Africans and Irish on both sides of the Troubles were able to be physically brave and take direct action to some extent because when they were growing up, their minds and emotions hadn't been crippled by being refused permission to speak. Remember, speech is always the first step to action, which is why Western regimes fear it so, and why here in America they're so desperate to find some way around the First Amendment so they can start locking up political opponents, to the point of imprisoning Bill White for posting public record information on his website and arresting that poor kid in Kentucky for posting a poem to the internet. They know that if we become afraid to speak political incorrectness, that someday we will be afraid even to think it, which is what they ultimately want. It's thought control. White people today live in a state of fear and ignorance. You would be amazed at how many American whites believe that it's actually illegal to say anything racial out loud or write anything politically incorrect. Northern Ireland wasn't like here, where everybody is still sitting around, hunkered down behind their computers, waiting for somebody else to go first. In Ireland, somebody already did go first, back in 1916, and so the cat was already out of the bag. Finally, there is the obvious difference that in white Africa and in Ireland in the 1950s and 1960s, most young white boys were raised in traditional two-parent families where they had a father as a strong male role model and a mother to give emotional and moral balance to their characters, and that no longer applies. Many, if not most, young white people today are raised either in single-parent families or else in households with one partner in the relationship who's a step-parent, and the partners may not even be married to each other. I don't think it's possible to overstate the terrible effect that the destruction of the traditional nuclear family has had on several generations of white children. It's difficult to assess just which of our many problems causes what percentage of our many weaknesses, including cowardice and laziness, but absence of a stable two-parent family unit certainly is a large contributory factor. how can we white Americans in the early 21st century become like these other men I knew in my youth, men who were born about the same time as I was, but who grew up in other countries in environments which were largely absent the kind, or at least the level, of moral poison constantly spewing from the Jew tube and the whole counterculture thing? Or, as I have put it myself in the past, how can we become the kind of men our great-grandfathers were? How do we transform ourselves? How do we get rid of all the poison that the Jews have dumped into us since birth? This question mark is probably the purest essence of the message I'm trying to convey, and which I've been trying to get across for decades now. There simply is no 25 words or less answer. I will most likely spend the rest of my life trying to answer your question. I think I know, but it's very hard for me to put all of this in words. Every time I do, I'm going to fail to connect with most people because the common language and experience simply won't be there, but I will never stop trying. As far as holding down a day job, you do that because you have to. Virtually none of us in the movement, such as it is, have any choice. Even those of us who are in fact qualified to do serious academic or business or scientific or medical related things usually are not allowed to make a living in our actual professions for a variety of reasons, most of which are not our fault and have to do with the whole affirmative action system, and also on occasion with various types of retaliation for past political and personal indiscretions. But you have to do it unless you're independently wealthy. And if that's the case, please email me at nwnet@earthlink.net because I want some of that independent wealth to finance a revolutionary independence movement here in the Northwest. You have to do all this day job crap because politically correct society makes you do it in order to survive. You cannot be effective and do anything at all for your race and your civilization while you're living under a bridge or in a Salvation Army homeless shelter. You do what you have to do, and that includes working a day job that most likely bores you to the point of gibbering insanity, if you're lucky enough to have one, that is. These days, one out of every five white males isn't so lucky. It's just one of those things that comes with the territory, and I've always accepted it. Now, as to dealing with hostile family, yes, this is a very common movement phenomenon. In fact, it's so common that one might say it's the rule and not the exception. I can count on my fingers the number of movement people I've known down through the years whose families would even still speak to them, never mind who were in any way supportive, even to the point of allowing their erring racist relatives to come over for dinner on occasion. Again, Mark, you have to simply accept the way the world is and accept that certain things come with the territory. When I was in Ireland, a senior IRA man was being interviewed by some liberal magazine or other, and the female reporter was berating him for making orphans out of the children of British soldiers and RUC officers and IRA bomb and gun victims, and the IRA man replied, "I will not be blackmailed by the tears of children into failing in my duty to my country." That is to some extent the attitude we have to take. I will not be blackmailed by the members of my family into failing in my duty to my race, because that duty is in fact more important than any personal or family consideration. Because if you fail in that duty, you are raising your sons to be slaves and your daughters to be whores for niggers. And I mean that. The way things are going, that is most likely to be quite literally the case. If you really care for your children, you will stop screwing around, tapping on a keyboard and listening to podcasts on the internet, including this one, and tomorrow you will use that computer to start an internet search for jobs in the Pacific Northwest and to locate a good, inexpensive moving van service. Francis Parker Yockey wrote in Imperium, "This destiny does not tire, nor can it be broken, and its mantle of strength descends upon those in its service." The crux of it is, Mark, that if we wish to serve this destiny, as Yockey would have understood the term, we must become hard men, impervious to feelings, to desire, to regret, to anger, to any emotion. We have to become kind of a racist Mr. Spock. Everything must be sacrificed to the world to come, and we have to accept that this will leave little time or place in our hearts for the world that is past or the world as it is now. Dear HAC, it's very simple. Everybody wants to see you on TV every night. You're not real unless you're on television. I know this allows the enemy to select and define who their opposition is to be, but this is the way Americans think. There are two worlds they live in, the one around them and the one they see on their TV and computer screens, and they prefer the one on the screen. I got a somewhat similar email from Miranda in, I don't know where she's from, wanting to know why the Northwest Front doesn't have public rallies like the so-called NSM. Okay, let's talk about streetwalking and publicity. One of the movement's most sacred cows is the streetwalk, otherwise known, almost always incorrectly, as a quote-unquote rally. The problem with that is that Zog and the media controls how much and what, if anything, the white population is allowed to see and hear of such activities. We are presented not as news, but as entertainment, which is what the masses, or the masses, as an old wobbly called them, expect from their television. Look at the funny racists in the funny clothes. Now stay tuned for American Idol. Does this mean we would get any better results if all the streetwalkers wore suits and ties? No, it doesn't. That's been tried. Too. When we wear suits and ties, then they ignore us completely. The unwritten but ironclad rule is that if we're not making fools of ourselves by making ourselves look strange or tattooed or shaven-headed or drunk or yelling obscenities or holding up signs saying gas Jews or such stupid crap, no TV cameras. The publicity always focuses on how we look rather than on what we say. Visual rather than verbal content. Now, this is one reason that I will only do media interviews by email. I don't do a lot of interviews, as you can guess. Secondly, there is, again, that issue of white character, which we refuse to address. The fact is that the overwhelming majority of white people are simply morally incapable of giving us the kind of reaction that we seek from them through this kind of activity. We are speaking to their great-grandfathers, not to them. White Americans simply don't get propaganda of the deed, even when it's violent and bloody. It is useless to appeal to the nobler nature and better instincts of the white majority. They have none. They've been deliberately engineered that way. They will never respond to any kind of mass movement tactics because the necessary moral instincts, frames of reference, and cultural motivations have been socially engineered out of them. The fact is that we are not going to be able to beat this evil tyranny with any kind of symbolic act. It's going to have to be the real thing. If they are ever going to be dragged out of their carpeted offices and their executive boardrooms and their fancy trendy clubs and restaurants, then we're going to have to go in and dig them out by force like moray eels. As an interesting digression, while Sinn Féin does hold demonstrations regularly in Ireland, A, they have the many thousands in numbers needed to do it right, and B, the actual volunteers of the IRA are under orders to stay away from such events to prevent their being photographed or arrested. We've been doing these tiny little rallies, so-called, for a good 50 years now. Where are the results? Where are the visible results of any of it, anything we've done for the past 50 years? How much actual political, racial, or demographic change has come about from any of it? I ask you point blank, is this what we need to be spending the next 20 years doing, in view of the fact that it's probably the last 20 years we'll have? Again, I say, it is time for us to sit down, reassess, and rethink all of this. The next email comes from a comrade in New York whom I won't name because I don't want to embarrass him or have him feel like I'm targeting him in any way. The fact is that his viewpoint is a very common one in the racially conscious community. Dear HAC, you know, maybe it is all a hobby and a waste of time. Don't worry, I'm not going to stop supporting you because you're right, it is the right thing to do. I can't do much for you, but what I can do, I will, but I don't expect any results. I'm sorry, I just don't believe that we can win. Well, I could go off into a long digression on history and economics and all kinds of other subjects to demonstrate that it is indeed possible for us to win, but the fact is that in the final analysis, whether we win or not is going to depend entirely on two groups of people, the white people who are with us and the white people who are against us. So what I'm going to do now is to speak directly to both of those groups of people. As always, when it really boils down to the nitty-gritty, the coming conflict in the Northwest is going to be a civil war between whites caused by the presence on this continent of non-whites, just like the first one. First, I want to address the people who are listening to these podcasts who will be among the Northwest Republic's enemies. Right at the moment, judging from our stat counter, that's mostly going to be cops of various sorts, FBI, Homeland Security, Secret Service. There also may be a few condescending liberals and whacked-out college punk neo-Marxist types listening in. To you, I would start off by saying that I imagine you're all pretty confident. After all, any rational observer would say that your side has all the cards. So you may be laughing at me right now and say, hey, how can we lose? But you will. Oh yeah, you're going to lose. Eventually. You do what you do for money. Sure, money can beat us for a time. It has so far, and it'll beat us for a while yet, but not forever. Now I want to talk to the second group of people who will someday decide the fate of our new Northwest Nation, a much smaller group of people, the white men and women who are with us now and who will be with us when the time comes. And you ask me how you can change, how you can become the kind of men and women who will one day beat these bastards who are listening in and watching us down into the dust and rip their hearts out. There are two things holding you back, fear and ego. You must banish both from your mind, your heart, and your soul, because if you try to carry them into battle, you won't make it, and you will bring others down with you. You must listen to the voice that speaks inside the mind, the voice that tells you what you must do, the voice that you have been conditioned all your life to suppress and to ignore. Yes, surprise, surprise, the Northwest Front is on the enemy radar, and also, in light of my personal rant towards the end of last week's broadcast, maybe a somewhat more calm and methodical commentary on dealing with these hoods might be in order. First off, we tend to give the organs credit for a lot more subtlety than they in fact possess. You have to bear in mind that federal law enforcement personnel are not actually real cops. What they are is what was called apparatchiks in the old Soviet Union, parts of an apparatus. They're basically bureaucrats and careerists with badges and guns, and this is the key to understanding them. Now, these people make their careers, get their promotions, get their cushy postings to New York or D.C. or Hawaii or wherever they want to go, not just through the usual bureaucratic ass-kissing and intrigue, but through racking up arrests and convictions, whether of guilty or innocent people doesn't really matter. They literally build their careers on human bodies and the destruction of people's lives, and in order to score their brownie points with the Bureau or whoever, they have to do it openly and by the book so that they get credit and it goes in their personnel jacket. That means that when they're just creeping around like this, they're usually just messing with you. If they actually have any excuse to arrest anybody, they'll almost always go ahead and do it. Now, this stuff you see on TV about the FBI weaving all these complex stings and stuff is crap. When you really need to be worried is not when they're creeping around and sneaking into your home trying to plant spy software on your computer, but when you've got somebody on your own team who won't shut up about illegal activity and who's pretty clearly trying to talk people into breaking the law. Now, that is a warning signal you don't dare ignore. A minor sneak and peek, like what happened to our guy a couple of months ago, is most likely what federal employees call a budget burner. And once you're on their radar, they're going to use you for that purpose, to burn budget. Another thing about these little visits we may get from our friends in the silk suits, a lot of what they're trying to accomplish is to build up potential networks of informants by finding people who will talk to them at all about anything. Sports, weather, politics, doesn't matter, because that leads to other stuff. When the organs show up at your door for the first time, they're scoping you out as a potential snitch simply by asking you a few innocuous questions about nothing in particular. Your answers to those questions are not so important in themselves as the fact that you answer them at all. And if you do, the first time they leave, they will mark you down in their little notebook and their files as a potential source, as someone who will talk to them. And that's what you don't want, because once you establish that you will talk to them about anything, then they're going to keep coming back looking for more and more information. Information about more and more people. They especially love to locate smart-ass right-winger types, shithouse lawyers, who want to show off how clever they are and how much they know about the Constitution and the law and who will run their mouths to prove that point, which of course they aren't. Smart, that is. Federal agents are, among other things, trained intelligence analysts. As long as the noise is coming out of your mouth, they will find some way to extract information from it, and they will use that information to destroy human lives, including your own. I'll tell you what has worked for me in the past, so far at least. When federal agents come to your door and say that they want to ask you questions, the very first words out of your mouth must be, "Do you have a warrant?" If they try to bluster or BS you off the subject, repeat the question, "Do you have a warrant?" Do not allow them to evade that question. Say nothing else until they answer the question. And above all, do not let them in voluntarily. Do not let them go to the bathroom or get a drink of water or use the phone or anything like that. Because once they're inside, they will find some way to wander all over your home, sneaking and peeking. By way of full disclosure, the one time I have ever let the cops into my crib voluntarily was 7 years ago in Centralia, Washington, when three local police showed up at 11 o'clock at night and said they had a call that I was quote-unquote killing Jews in my apartment, and I invited them in to see for themselves that I didn't have any dead bodies under the bed, after which they apologized and left. They'd already figured out that it was a crank call, but they had to check it out. But that was a different situation from a federal fishing expedition. If the agents do have a warrant, most likely they won't be knocking on the door anyway. They'll be kicking it down about dawn and screaming threats at you and throwing you on the floor and sticking automatic weapons in your back. Or more likely, hiding behind the local police SWAT team while they do it. Now, getting back to the situation where you have a couple of droids standing on your doorstep, if they don't have a warrant, then you simply say, "Come back when you get one," and immediately close the the door. That's important. Close the door. Don't stand there with it open waiting for them to go away. They won't go away. They'll try to engage you in further conversation and persuade you to invite them in so that they can sneak and peek. Do not give them any opportunity to say anything else. Once you have told them to come back with a warrant, close the door. If they force their way into your home without a warrant, which they can now legally do under the Patriot Act and the Military Commissions Act of 2006, then is when the five words kick in. I have nothing to say. Do not try to bandy words or debate with them or show them how clever you are about the law and the Constitution. The FBI and the DHS know all about the Constitution. They simply choose to ignore it because they can. Don't try to tell them you have rights. Out here in the real world, you are a racially aware white man, and so no, you don't. They may try to verbally provoke you into assaulting them so that they can arrest you and have a charge to hold over your head. Don't fall for it. Answer every question with either I want an attorney or I have nothing to say. And then when your attorney arrives, you still have nothing to say. Remember, these people have one purpose only, and that is to do harm. The prisons are full of men and women who talked their way right into that cell because they had the idea that if they could just explain it all or whatever it is, then the cops or whatever would just go away and leave them alone and let them go home. It doesn't work like that. Five words. I have nothing to say. Those five words can save your life, literally. All it takes is a few words coming out of your mouth to destroy your life and the lives of countless other people forever. The only way you can avoid that is to make sure that only five words ever come out of your mouth. I have nothing to say. Throughout the so-called movement, deeply embedded therein, runs a streak of profound and overpowering defeatism. The terrible fact is that most of us have accepted in our own mind that our race is completely doomed, that there is nothing that can actually be done to save our people or Western civilization, and that any attempt to try is foredoomed and very dangerous. The Northwest Front rejects that absolutely. I say again that our whole strategy is based on one primary actual physical act. A deed, which although perfectly legal, will eventually lead to revolution because in addition to its strategic and tactical value, homecoming produces a profound moral and psychological victory. It breaks the pattern of passive acceptance and gets white people back into the habit of doing rather than saying, and puts an end to the interminable tap, 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 tap. At least it will do if we can ever fix our character problem. There's something else. Growing out of this sense of hopeless defeatism, there is also, they think, some kind of tacit agreement we have with Zog. The so-called leaders in the existing movement, such as they are, and such as it is, know in their hearts that they don't really mean it. And they think Zog knows and accepts that as well, and so will refrain from crushing us so long as we don't rock the boat. Well, they're half right. Let's be honest, guys. Collectively speaking, we don't really mean any of this racial stuff we babble about on the internet. I mean, come on. For once, let's tell it like it is. If we meant any of this, we wouldn't be babbling about it on the internet. We'd be out there in the real world doing real things. Barefoot Iraqis and Afghans with nothing but an AK-47 and a couple of magazines can fight against the same tyrant who oppresses us, and do so with at least partial success now, and eventually, I believe, with complete success. We can't, apparently. These people we despise and whom we call ragheads and sand niggers will fight. We won't. The difference is simple. They believe. We don't. Oh, I have no doubt that all of us would sincerely love to see social, racial, and political change, so long as we could sit back and watch it happen on TV without undergoing any personal risk or inconvenience. But with that attitude and a dollar, we can buy a small cup of coffee at McDonald's. It's time we looked a brutal fact in the face. None of us feels sufficiently strongly about our so-called racial ideals to place our physical bodies at risk of death, prison, pain, or even moderately uncomfortable physical exercise. We know that life for our children and our grandchildren is going to be a hell we cannot even imagine, and we do nothing about it because it's too hard and too dangerous. The armchair is too soft, the beer is too cold, and the nachos too salty and tasty. We're going to do just like our own grandfathers and fathers did. We're going to sit back, enjoy the ride as much as we can, and let our own children and grandchildren fend for themselves. That has been the unspoken movement attitude for 50 years. Then along comes Northwest Migration. For the first time, we have a chance to change ourselves inside by adopting a simple program, the Butler Plan, and just acting upon it. Really doing it and not just talking about it. It's safe and it's legal. The only danger is economic, and that can be avoided as well with a little effort and advance planning. Now, laying the merits of the idea itself aside for the moment, what is Northwest Migration? It is first and foremost an act. It involves physical motion, doing physical things with the body and with material objects, like packing one's possessions into a van, driving up an interstate highway to the Northwest homeland, not sitting behind a computer screen and playing in the artificial virtual movement that exists on the V-Bulletin boards and the internet forums. These acts are not of themselves illegal. The Northwest novels are fiction. There is no NVA yet. In real life, no one is asking you to shoot anybody or detonate a bomb or break a single law that will get you in trouble. Northwest Migration is completely lawful, and once the preliminary hurdles are overcome, it is actually in your self-interest, since the Northwest is one of the very few remaining decent places to live on this continent. As an aside, I have yet to hear of anyone leaving here once they get properly settled in and established. I've heard of people turning down six-figure salaries rather than relocate from the Northwest back to California or Chicago. But at the risk of repeating myself to the point of boring you, I cannot emphasize enough that the precedent of doing rather than talking is what makes us different. Okay, in the real world, it's not working out as well as it might so far due to our poor character. I can give you information, I can give you ideas, I can give you knowledge, I can give you encouragement, but I cannot make you brave and I cannot make you strong. That you have to do for yourself. And yes, you can, because it's in your genetic makeup. You just have to find it. Somehow, down through the years, we have bought into this false idea that knowledge alone is enough. How many times have we heard this business about, well, we have to educate our own people, and when this and this or that happens, it'll wake white people up. Okay, but once you get white people all awake, what then? You folks may or may not know who Corneliu Codrianu was. That's another one of those names that everyone who calls himself a white nationalist ought to know, but almost no one does. He was the head of the Iron Guard in Romania in the 1930s, and he was eventually murdered by the communists. Some liberal type was once nattering at him about the Iron Guard's program, and Codrianu told him, "Romania doesn't need programs. Romania needs men. So does the Northwest." The one thing that distinguishes the American racial right above all things is that it is almost completely devoid of action of any kind. We've spent the past 60 years trying to fight against this terrible evil with nothing but words, and it clearly isn't working. We have to somehow break out of this paralyzed mindset that prevents us from acting. The Northwest Front is the beginning of that process, and that's what makes us different. I got one email from a lady who asked a series of long and very good questions about homecoming, and she concluded with a request that I use part of one of these Radio Free Northwest podcasts to go over all of the practical reasons why white people should come Northwest and the emotional and spiritual aspects of homecoming. Okay, fair enough. Look, there are a host of reasons why you may not feel that you can move, and let's can all that crap about, oh, Harold, I just can't move right now. Time and events are not standing still here, and experience shows that vague promises to come home next year or the year after in practice means never. Like I said, I get the reasons why not. Not all of them are bad reasons having to do with laziness and chicken shit cowardice, inability to sell a house, a good job with people you may like, family commitments, love of place, and all these are perfectly understandable and logical reasons to stay where you are, as well as laziness and chicken shit cowardice. All right, Harvey's telling me to shut up. But we need to be honest, people. Northwest Migration aside, the coming decades are going to be full of problems and chaos everywhere. And one way or the other, there will be a lot of migration going on the part of everybody, a lot of it unwilling and unwanted. Northwest Migration is a good and sensible answer to a lot of the problems you may have in your personal and family life, and these are problems that you're going to have to deal with one way or the other. And while it's not easy, it's always easier to consciously choose to step away before you are forced to leave than it is to abandon your home in pain and storm and disaster when something happens that makes it absolutely impossible for you to remain where you are any longer. All this talk about standing and fighting is bullshit, yet another excuse not to come home. No one is standing and fighting anywhere. For white people, getting out of Dodge is the way to go, to the Northwest, where we can build communities and someday really stand and fight with our own people around us. People, things are going to get bad, bad, bad. You really should consider leaving where you are and doing it sooner rather than later, because you have little or no hope of successfully remaining in place in the storm that is coming. Okay, I get that some of this comes down to long versus short-term issues, and there are balances to be struck. For example, let's say you're in your 50s or 60s. Now, that's a bad time of life to make a move, true. But think about what's in store for you when you're in your 80s. What the country will be like then. Do you really want to have to face living in a nigger ghetto or a Mexican barrio as an 80-year-old white man or woman? Do you have a support network that will help you if you stay? If you wait to make the move until things get much worse, how likely is it that you'll be able to sell your house as the area you live in becomes unfit for human habitation? You may be worried that you can't get your equity out now. Well, what about another 5 years or 10? Do you really want to gamble on the system being able to right itself? I mean, you do realize, don't you, that the great housing boom of the early 2000s is gone forever and it's not coming back? You may be one of those stubborn people who just says, "This is my home and I'm staying here." Well, I got a hot flash for you. Your right to live where and how you want is not inviolable. When things get worse and worse, no one is going to care about you or what you want or your so-called rights. In case you hadn't noticed, white people don't run this country anymore except for the very super rich ones at the top. You call the police, there's a chance that the officer who responds is going to have a black or brown face. What kind of help or support for your so-called rights do you think you're going to get there? Okay, look, here's my list of how to think seriously about coming home. Now, things will be different, and there will be exceptions in every case, I know. Number one, if you were stupid enough to sign an adjustable rate mortgage back during the housing boom and you can't reset it, if you're already facing foreclosure and have no reason to believe you'll be able to pay for your house, or if your current house was bought near the market peak and you require two full incomes to pay for it and you have little equity, then I think you need to read the handwriting on the wall. The odds are good you're going to lose your house anyway, because all it will take is one lost job and one lost income, and that can happen in a heartbeat these days. Tomorrow morning, you could find yourself without an income. Do not go frantically into debt trying to keep your old way of life up and running. That closes off other options even worse. If you can see the train coming down at you full speed, get off the tracks. Go ahead and sell up and come home to the Northwest. If you do end up in full foreclosure, remember the magic words, produce the note. Require that the company do full due diligence and then stay in your house and live free as long as you can. You might as well save up rent and deposits for your homecoming to the Northwest. Number two, if you have young children, you really need to think about getting them into a permanent situation and living area now, while they're still too young to remember Minneapolis or Miami or wherever the hell they're living at present, so that they can have a stable future life. Ripping up a kid when they're 10 or 12 or a teenager is usually not a good idea if it can be at all avoided. Number three, many, many, entirely too many middle-aged white people, especially white males, end up getting stuck with caring for elderly parents, especially if you're divorced and if you have married siblings. Now, I have seen this kind of thing happen so often, I swear it follows some kind of script. As much as I hate to sound mean and cruel to the old folks, especially since I'm well on the way to becoming one myself, I have to take a purely rational and pragmatic position here. The Northwest Republic needs you. Your people need you more than one person needs you. Long experience teaches me enough to warn you guys that if you allow yourself to get sucked into the position of being the primary or sole resource of an elderly person or couple, then that's pretty much you gone. Congratulations, you have your excuse to sit out the movement and the revolution for the duration. Got responsibilities, you see. Got to take care of the old folks. The problem is, and let me say this again clearly, your people need you more than one person does. That is a moral decision that you are going to have to make on your own. I can't make it for you. Number four, getting back to the house selling thing, another point just occurred to me. If you need income from the sale of your house, you might want to think about selling sooner rather than later, because there will probably come a point at which the number of people who want to live wherever you live now declines dramatically, and it will be even tougher to sell than it is now. Now, even if some places do become uninhabitable, they probably won't do so immediately, but remember that it will probably become gradually and increasingly harder to live there, and as the area around you deteriorates, deteriorates and turns into a zoo, the likelihood of your getting out, short of packing the car in a U-Haul and downright fleeing to the Northwest, becomes ever more bleak. You know, someday we're going to have that situation. People are going to simply pack their cars and flee to the Northwest with nothing but the shirts on their backs. You might want to think about getting in ahead of the rush. Number 5, never forget how just plain physically dangerous it can be living around large numbers of blacks and Mexicans, and it will get even more dangerous as the time goes on. Staying where you are can get you killed, literally, as in waking up in the middle of the night and finding some nigger or Mexican standing over your bed with an iron bar or a butcher knife in his hand. Now, that applies especially when you get older. It is notorious that elderly white people are easy targets in racially mixed neighborhoods. The stupid niggers or beaners always assume that old white people have a fortune stuffed in their mattresses, being as they're too stupid to realize that if the old white guy had any money, he wouldn't be living around them. Number 6. If you have children, think hard. What kind of future do they have where you are now? You really need to think about the larger consequences of committing to a place that almost certainly does not have a future. Your children will probably have to leave to get work at the very least. They may have to go into the military because those are the only jobs available these days for white boys. We've got 50 years of Democrat rule coming, so stop counting on the Republicans to save you. If you have land or something you hope to pass down to your kids, what will it be worth 30 years from now? You see, this is the whole key to homecoming, thinking about the big picture, about the future, not just the inconveniences of the present. Number 7. If your present home is untenable and you plan to move anyway, why not come all the way northwest? There are people on this list who came west from the East Coast and stopped just short of the homeland. They ended up in places like South Dakota and Salt Lake City. They moved northward in California out of Los Angeles, but they stopped short of the Oregon state line. Why the hell not come all the way? I've never understood that. I think there must be something that frightens people about making that last step, admitting that Harold was right, driving those last few miles and settling down in the Northwest homeland itself. Look, if you're going to do it right. Don't make a half-assed migration a homecoming light. Go all the way. Come here, to the Pacific Northwest, and don't dick around with the Dakotas or Northern California or Alaska or whatever. By the same token, I notice that a lot of homecomers, and yes, we are starting to get some, pointedly avoid the area where I myself am. It's like they're afraid I'll make demands on their time and resources, and they're right, I will. But that's fine. I know a lot of people aren't coming here to the Northwest to help me or the NF. They're coming here to find a little hole in the woods to hide in from the big bad Obama and pull it in after them. Now, that's fine. Look, it's better to do the right thing for the wrong reason than to do the wrong thing for any reason. As long as you land your ass here in the Northwest, you're headed in the right direction. Look, my position is simple. It is time for the endless debate to end. It is time for the endless introspection and contemplation of our navels to end. All this sound and fury on the internet and this gibbering on V-bulletin boards like VNN is simply an excuse to continue to do nothing. We do not need more debate. That part of things has been decided with the Butler Plan. We now need action to implement it. There is no longer any serious question about what we have to do. I say again and again and again, as long as I need to say it, that Northwest migration is the only game in town for the white race. The other groups and the other fearless leaders have had their chance. They've had their chance for the past 50 years to come up with some kind of plan or strategy that will succeed in securing the existence of our people and a future for white children, and they've come up empty. Zip, zilch, nada. The Northwest migration is it. So you need to decide what the hell it is you're going to do. How long are you just going to continue to sit there behind that computer and post to Stormfront and VNN and pretend that you're actually accomplishing something? That's the question. And I understand that certain people with a vested interest in the status quo aren't too happy about my asking that question, which is why I'm banned from VNN. Most of the objections that people make to me about coming home are legitimate in and of themselves. I get it. I just went over a number of those issues a few minutes ago. I don't want them to feel that I'm singling them out, but I am desperately trying to convey to you folks some sense of urgency about this. Our time is no longer infinite, and doing nothing simply is no longer an option. All right, the next email is from Phil in Arkansas. I'll deal with it in multiple parts. Dear Harold, need a step-by-step guide to repairing white character, not simply you need to become the men your great-grandfathers would recognize, rather something like a 2-week plan on day 1 do this, day 2 the next thing, etc., etc. Phil, I wish to God that there was such a plan, but there isn't. The process of character rebirth that I talk about is a mystical experience that many occult sages and whatnot have sought all of their lives and never found. It is a completely individual experience that varies from individual to individual, and I'm repeating myself there, but you get the idea. There is no 12-step program to make a white man a man again. Maybe we can actually design some kind of 12-step program for American Assholes Anonymous, I don't know. But even if we did, we couldn't force them to do it, because these transformations are all internal and there's no way we can get inside their heads, at least not without coercive state power. Problem is that spiritual transformation requires intense internal self-analysis and insight into the whole human condition, and yet so few young white people have been taught how to think. They've been taught to feel instead, and feelings alone won't cut it. Emotion on its own cannot bring about a total spiritual transfiguration like I envision. It takes a large dose of good, hard, cold intellect, as well as will in the Nietzschean sense with a capital W, and that is almost completely absent from young white boys today. Phil, you want basically a 12-step program to turn a pale 2010 kid into a young man from 100 years ago. I can't give you 12 steps, but for anyone out there who wants to give the old transfiguration trick a shot, here's a couple of steps you might try. First off, remove yourself from the computer as much as possible. Use the time you save to sit down and read books. Do that for about a year. Force yourself to stay away from the electronic screens of both the television and the personal computer for as much as you can and read books. As to what you should read, we do have a recommended reading list for the NF, and I need to dust that off anyway and start distributing it. You can email me for a copy of it. But the main thing is that you slow down and start reading instead of staring at electronic images on a screen. Step two, once you've shaken as much of the electronic goop out of your head as you can shake, look very carefully at the world around you. Study what makes it tick and how it works. Begin to extrapolate. Look into the future and try and envision what the world's going to be like in 20 or 30 years if nothing is done. Again, don't feel, think. Step three, okay, there is a religious or psychic or metaphysical aspect to all this that I myself can't supply for the individual person. I'm not going to go into my own views on the subject because this isn't about me or what works for me. As I've said, this is all individual and each person is different. But the upshot of it is that you need to examine your own metaphysical or religious worldview and determine your place in it. What does God or the gods or the force or the great pumpkin or whatever want you to do, if anything? Suppose he, she, they, or it don't want you to do anything and just put you here and walked away. Well, then it's all up to you what you do with your life, right? So if you choose to devote it to your people and their racial survival, God won't be mad with you. Do you believe, I mean, honestly believe, that God has ordained the United States of America as some kind of divine institution to rule over mankind, and that if you revolt against the United States, God's going to cast you into a lake of burning fire forever and ever? Anyway, the long and the short of it is you need to assert your intellect and your will over your emotions and your adrenal glands. You need to make a conscious and rational decision as to what kind of man or woman you are going to be, and then be that person. You must make a conscious, deliberate decision that you will no longer be a whiskey priest, that you will not only know what is right, but that you will do it. Phil, I'm sorry that's as close as I can get to getting into somebody else's head and telling them how they can accomplish something which is intensely personal and as unique to every individual as his fingerprint or his DNA. I could babble on and on here for 10 hours and still do no better. Sometimes I'm asked by our supporters if there is in fact a plan, a long-range strategy for the Northwest Front, or are we just going to have to play it all by ear? Now, the answer is that we will indeed be forced by circumstances to play a lot of it by ear, yes, but there is a plan. I think it's time I let you guys have a look at it now, and if some government lawyer wants to claim I'm conspiring for or against something, what the hell? Look, these people in the expensive suits with the government paychecks going into their bank accounts every month by direct deposit are going to do whatever the hell they're going to do until the direct deposits stop coming, and there's not a damn thing that I or anybody else can do to stop them. I have to accept this and say what has to be said. After all, that's what you guys pay me the big bucks for. The reason I have to take this chance is that given our lack of resources, I'm not going to be able to meet with all of you personally and talk to you about this anytime soon. and I'm getting a feeling that events may be about to overtake us. I refer to the unlawful searching of a Northwest Front supporter's home in March by government agents. I refer to the arrest of Idaho attorney Edgar Steele by the FBI on charges which, in my view, do not stand up to any reasonable standards of credibility, and certain other incidents which I won't discuss here that indicate an increased possibility that I myself may be taken out of the picture soon, one way or the other. Now, I'm aware that many of you feel I'm probably being paranoid about that. I sincerely hope that you're correct, but it's better to be safe than sorry. I think I need to talk about these things with you now, openly, because, let me put this bluntly, there's a high likelihood that you people may have to carry out this strategy without me. The first thing that must be done before anything else is that we must accumulate a large number of what I call Class A's here in the Northwest. By that, I refer to mature, intelligent, dedicated, motivated, and courageous white people who are willing to go beyond talk and who will act. Movement dysfunctionals, kooks, and creeps need not apply, and they must be ruthlessly weeded out in a genuine, serious manner like no other movement group has ever attempted to do. Now, that's our first step. It's a tall order, and it's one of the reasons I'm ranting and raving at you every week on these podcasts. I'm trying to get through to the Class A's among you and get your asses up here in the Northwest where you belong. Now, that's the first part of the plan. When I finally do succeed in pounding the message through your heads and you finally do quit jerking me around and get your butts up here, these good people must be organized into teams or cells of between 3 and 6 people maximum, and these teams must be distributed all over the Northwest, but as much as possible in areas of higher population density and economic viability. All these people are going to need jobs, and in real life, unless you're really skilled, it's going to be hard for an outsider to find work in Devil's Outhouse, Montana. You need to try Seattle or Portland or at least Spokane or Eugene or Boise. Ideally, the median age of these people should be as young as possible. I know that many of our most dedicated supporters and activists are in middle age or older, including myself. But I must repeat that revolution is a young man's game, and we can't defeat the tyranny that rules us with an army of geriatrics. As to how many of these Class A people we need, I keep talking about 1,000 people, but that number is in fact somewhat flexible. We may have to make do with a little fewer than that, but it better not be by much. 1,000 is a minimum number. Ideally, before we proceed to the next step, we need many more than that. The accumulation of these Class A people here in the homeland and not fucking off behind personal computers in Michigan or Florida or California is the stage we're in now, and I don't have to tell you so far we ain't doing so hot. I have not yet found the magic beans, the magic words, the secret to battering some kind of sense of urgency and some kind of sense of racial responsibility into your skulls. I have to use the stick because I don't have a carrot. Believe me, if I had any way to pay or bribe you guys to do the right thing, I would. If I could pay even a small salary, I know I could have a full staff of 24 skilled people up here next week. And then again, if wishes were horses, then beggars would ride. But we must persevere and continue to locate, identify, and motivate good people to dedicate themselves to the Republic and to manifest that dedication by coming home here to the Pacific Northwest. We have to start thinking about this dead seriously. And seriously speaking, we cannot and must not get bored and frustrated, lose patience, and attempt to move on to the next stage with a scattered handful of people. The Order tried that with about 24 guys, and we all know how they ended up. How long will it take us to accomplish this? I don't know. You tell me. How long will it take for there to be this great awakening among the last remnants of our people? How long is a piece of string? The next step for us will be the creation not of the NVA, but of the National Convention as described in the draft Northwest Constitution. This was the first step in Ireland. The creation of Dáil Éireann, the Irish Parliament, that is the official legislature in the Irish Republic to this day. Dáil Éireann was created in 1918, while Ireland was still part of the British Empire, and for the first few years of its existence, it was an illegal shadow government which had to meet in cow barns, in the back rooms of pubs, and out in the woods, in the mountains, by the light of the moon. The first speaker of the Dáil was Éamon de Valera, who later became Prime Minister and then President of Ireland. Now, this strategy worked 100 years ago, and so it will work for us if we can get some guts, get a few brain cells to rub together, and then combine the two. Once we have a sufficient number of Class A people so that we can form a shadow government for the Northwest Republic, with someone besides Beavis and Butthead as officers and ministers of state, we must establish the National Convention in some kind of founding gesture. This is where we can use all these intellectual racists like the Kevin MacDonald and Occidental Descent types with college degrees papering their walls. That is, if they can raise a few hair on their testicles. It'd be interesting to see if MacDonald himself would accept a position as a shadow cabinet minister for the National Convention. Whoever ends up involved in the formation of that shadow government, from that point on, our official line must be that the National Convention is the legal authority in the Northwest and not the American occupation regime or the state and local governments. We will be acting in the name of the law, the new law, our law. We will be acting in the name of the state, the new state, our state. It would probably not be a good idea to have a state president until the republic is established and an actual election can be held. Authority, at least moral authority, will have to reside in the Speaker of the Convention and in a Council of Ministers of State, who will become a cabinet once independence is obtained. The republic comes into being with the convention, just like on July 4, 1776, America came into being with the Declaration of Independence by the Continental Congress. Come on, guys, take notes now, because I say again, you're probably going to have to do all this without me. There is another step which must accompany the founding of the National Convention very closely, either just before or just afterward. Now, this will be the creation of the Northwest Volunteers, not the NVA, the Northwest Volunteers. Let me explain the difference. The NVA is a fictional paramilitary organization, the purpose of which is to engage in combat operations against the occupation forces and establish the independence of the Northwest Republic and the authority of the National Convention as that republic's lawful government, just as George Washington's Continental Army established the Continental Congress as the lawful government of the United States. The NVA does not exist. It cannot and must not exist until it can be established with some chance of success. That time is so far distant right now that this is indeed nothing but the rambling of one old man all alone in a little room somewhere speaking into a microphone. The Northwest Volunteers are something else, and their creation will be possible much sooner, because technically speaking, so far as I know, it will not violate any laws, although if lawyers try hard enough, they can always find something to charge somebody with. Let me explain the concept I envision for the Northwest Volunteers. As you all know, I chose the name Northwest Front for our movement specifically to avoid the implications of the word party, legally and organizationally speaking. We're not a party in the traditional sense. We have no hierarchy, no formal dues, no formal organization, no property for Morris Dees to seize in a malicious lawsuit. We travel pretty light and must continue to do so. I've said in the past that our movement must be an organism and not an organization, and that will have to continue to be the case, but at some point in time, that will have to change, at least partially, and we will have to develop into an effective weapon for revolution. That means organization and discipline, and it means that that's basically the point where things start to get serious. Also, as you know, our movement is as a whole comprised of many tendencies: extreme conservatives, Christian identity people, pagan and Wiccan people, militia survivalists, national socialists such as myself, constitutionalists, tax revolts, and sovereign citizen advocates, and half a dozen other strands which we have to braid into a rope that will hang the Americans. The Northwest Volunteers will be that rope that we braid from all the various tendencies which make up white nationalism. We talk a lot about white unity. Well, that will be our white unity for the first time manifested in reality. We talk a lot about building a racial elite. The Northwest Volunteers will be the first genuine racial elite since the SS of World War II. The relationship of the Northwest Volunteers to the rest of the Northwest Front will be that of the general staff to the rest of an army. Another parallel might be that while hundreds of thousands of people participate in organized crime in this country, Cosa Nostra itself consists of only 4,000 to 5,000 made or formal members. Within the Northwest Independence Movement, the Northwest Volunteer will be the equivalent of a made man in the mafia. The Northwest Volunteer will be a man or woman who voluntarily renounces the material things of this world and all that America offers by way of personal wealth and pleasure and social acceptance, in order to devote themselves and their entire lives to one cause, the establishment of the Northwest American Republic as a reality. He or she will voluntarily place themselves under military discipline, and that discipline will not be a burden. It will be their pride. Even in a pre-combat stage, they will become political soldiers. They will be the ones who give and take orders. When they are ordered to appear on a stretch of lonely highway at night in the middle of winter, they'll get in their car and they'll show up. When they are arrested, they will respond with, "I have nothing to say," for the next 20 years if need be. Basic stuff, the stuff of all true revolutionary movements, but something which the American white nationalist movement has never been able to achieve. I have described the Northwest Front as an organism and not an organization, as a binding together of all the strands of the movement, as disparate groups of people marching separately but striking together, all very loosey-goosey, no formal membership, no hierarchy, so forth and so on, and I mean it. It has to be that way. Note what I say here, not that it should be that way, but that it has to be that way. Why does it have to be that way? Because we are dealing with white Americans, and white Americans are incapable of doing anything else. They are incapable of self-discipline. Most will accept only the external discipline of money and the workplace, and precious little of that. The American work ethic notoriously sucks. White Americans have been conditioned from birth by the Jews to be completely narcissistic consumer animals who will not tolerate any attempt to control or restrain their impulses or their appetites. They will reject any force or idea which seeks to impose order and purpose on their self-centered, disorderly, and dysfunctional lives. Now, this is one of the main reasons that the United States military has so many washouts who never make it past basic training. I think it's best summed up, appropriately enough, by a slogan from a bird-brained television show that has become an American mantra. "You're not the boss of me." The problem is that if there is ever to be any real change, and if our race is to survive, as in continue to exist, then somebody has damn well got to be the boss of you. I have described the Northwest Front as it must be, given the times and given the human material that we have to work with. I didn't say I liked it, and I didn't say it would win. What our race desperately, frantically needs is a fighting revolutionary party of fanatical political soldiers working under an iron code of total and complete dedication to the 14 words to the exclusion of all else. The party we need should combine the racial ideals and moral clarity of Hitler's National Socialists, the discipline and the organization of Lenin's Bolsheviks, and the courage and daring of the IRA. I am not asking you to give me that party. I long ago accepted that I'm not going to get it. Through no fault of your own, with no blame attached to you, the tragic and brutal fact is that you are incapable of it. If nothing else, this is proven by the fact that 8 years after I myself came home, I am still not seeing those out-of-state license plates coming over the hill. Now let's cut right down to the bone, as close to the bone as it gets. If you are not capable of committing a simple, doable, perfectly legal act of faith, such as coming to the homeland, an act which is in fact to your own personal benefit in the long run, an act which almost all of you would do next week if you were only paid money, if you can't or won't even pack a moving van, then you're not capable of forming an organized and disciplined party and army of white revolutionaries. Before the Civil War, in slavery times, the niggers had their underground railroad that led north to freedom, so that they could work in mills and factories for 50 cents a day instead of chop cotton on a plantation. I wouldn't call that freedom, but some of them did. Anyway, in those days, the nigger slaves had a folk saying as to how to find their way north. They said, "The moss always grows on the north side of the tree." Our people's road to freedom lies northwest, and we don't need to know about moss because we don't need an underground railroad to take us to our homeland. It's here, waiting for us. And yet most of you hang your heads and shuffle your feet and make your excuses, and you will not take the freedom road. I'm not ragging on you. I'm not trying to humiliate you or insult you. I'm not trying to shame you into doing the right thing, although I can't say as I'd be unhappy if it did have that effect on someone. I say again, this is not your fault. It is the fault of the Jews who took away your manhood and made you what you are. Nobody is blaming you, least of all me. We have to play the cards we're dealt. But the simple fact remains, I have come to accept that almost none of you are emotionally or spiritually capable of responding to this deadly urgent crisis of civilization in the way that I ask of you. Almost none of you. I refuse to accept that I am the last of my kind. I refuse to accept that nowhere out there are there any more like me. I know that somewhere within the sound of my voice there are at least a few of you who have somehow managed to walk through the Jewish plague uncontaminated and untouched. A tiny handful of you who carry within your souls the old stuff, the right stuff. True, most of you who do have the old stuff, the right stuff within you are my own age or older. But we are not the last. Somewhere out in the chaos and the madness and the despair of Obama's America, there are young white men and women in their 30s, in their 20s, in their teens, who still have that hero gene in their makeup, that spark that allows for the lone wolf to survive in the forest away from the pack, that sliver of steel in their spine that makes a real man, a white man. One day, one of you other guys will be diddling away on your computers, chomping down on your nachos and sucking down your cold brew, and you will casually post to some bulletin board or some comments section on a blog, and without ever knowing it, you'll get a hit. Some young man or woman, 19 or 20, one of the last of the alpha whites, will see your post and follow it up and find that party website. One day, somehow, these few remaining alphas will find us. One day they will come to us. For every 99 of you sitting in New York and Wisconsin and Florida and Oklahoma who pause and shuffle and hang your heads and mumble excuses about jobs and college courses when I speak of homecoming, for every one of you who finds that lifting the cardboard boxes into the moving van or the U-Haul trailer is a task beyond your strength, there is one young man or woman who will leap to that task with fire in their blood and hope in their eyes, who once they understand cannot wait to take the road northwest. Those are our Northwest volunteers. Those will be the ones who do the heavy lifting, the ones who understand that before they fight and die for the homeland, they must first work for it. Those are the ones who will not run away from discipline, organization, and responsibility like Americans do, but who will run towards it like white men do. Yes, they are the ones who, some dark and foggy night, in someone's home in Washington or in a motel in Montana or in a barn in Oregon, will take the oath to the Northwest American Republic in front of the tricolor banner and a small gathering of loyal comrades. Those are the ones who will live for freedom in a new land, and who, when the time comes, will fight and die for it. They are there. They exist. We will find them, or they will find us, and they will come. And when the rest of you see them coming, and hear of their deeds here in this land that God and destiny has appointed for our people, you too will finally find the strength to pack that moving van and follow them. I'd like now to address one of the many criticisms that's been directed against the Northwest Imperative and against me personally with varying degrees of sincerity. I'm not talking about the Lords of V-Bulletin or other movement kooks, but real people who are genuinely disturbed and afraid and concerned. Are they worried about what one person referred to as my shouting for violence? They are afraid that any association with myself or with the Northwest Front will quote-unquote get them into trouble. Now, folks, I'm not going to lie to you. That's possible. Like all tyrannies, the Obama regime regularly practices guilt by association. Ask those Huttery militia people. The FBI didn't just arrest the one individual their informant set up. They also arrested seven other hapless people who had no idea about any so-called conspiracy and probably still don't know what hit them. Okay, look, I think most of you get the Northwest idea, or if not, you're starting to get it. So let me run this down for you guys again. I want to tell you just what I've been doing over the past 10 years. My main role in all this springs from my authorship of the four Northwest Independence novels. These novels are not primarily works of fiction. The purpose of fiction is to entertain. The four Northwest novels are political polemics that have been deliberately written from the ground up with a specific purpose in mind. Ever put together a jigsaw puzzle? Then you know that the first requirement is that you need the cover of the box so that you can see what the picture you're trying to assemble looks like when it's completed. Now, for decades, the white racial resistance movement in this country just sort of drifted without a plan and without a clue. My purpose in writing the four Northwest novels was to show you people the cover of the box, to show you what the finished product will look like. Yes, there are also elements of a how-to manual in there, and I make no apology for that. They're part of the cover of the puzzle box, showing you how the many pieces fit together. Now, I've been accused of trying to get white people into trouble by telling them what to do. That's not the case. In my novels, I am not telling white people what they should do. I am showing them what they should be. For all the many elements in my novels, everything from explosions and assassinations to high political theory to teenaged romance, these books are not about their actual plot lines. They're not about criminal activity. They're not about violence. They're not even about race and politics so much. They are about character. Do you guys get what I'm saying here? The Northwest novels are novels about white character, what it has been in the past and what it has to be in the future. What my individual characters like Cody Brock, Shane Ryan, and Zach Hatfield do in these books is not important. What's important is why they do it. My purpose in writing those novels was twofold. First and foremost, I wanted to convey to our people a sense of possibility about the coming Northwest American Republic. Now, one of the impediments to our progress seems to be a general desire to fast forward the tape, to find ourselves suddenly in a position where all the hard, inconvenient, and dangerous and expensive preliminary work has already been done by somebody else. No one can do that, but I can give our people a brief glimpse of what the fast-forwarded tape might look like during the later parts of the movie, so to speak. My object here is for readers to see and internalize the possibility of victory. To achieve this, I've resurrected some ancient themes and concepts that haven't been seen in American literature for some time, most notably the image of strong white males and a few strong white females fighting against the tyrannical and oppressive American regime in actual combat with weapons in their hands. The image of the white male fighting against the United States government with a weapon in his hand is an incredibly powerful one. It has an irresistible appeal to white readers, especially young white readers. And the only reason that there hasn't been much more buzz about the Northwest novels than there has been is that only a handful of people know that they exist. Now, if I can ever somehow persuade the 1,500 or so people on our present email list, plus all the listeners to Radio Free Northwest, to leave their present passive mode where they simply sit and watch or listen, and actively promote the Northwest novels on the internet and everywhere else, they could easily go viral. And all of a sudden, the Northwest series will have 1 million readers, it'll be a kind of a racist Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter phenomenon, and the Northwest movement's propaganda and financial problems will be pretty much solved, and we can move on to the next step. Now, the Northwest imperative would be catapulted by that into the big time. It's just getting that first few thousand people or so out of the passive mode and getting them to start actually doing some keyboard tapping and posting and chatting. That's the problem. I haven't found the right words yet. I haven't found the ignition key, but I will. Secondly, with these books, I'm attempting to do something which I'm amazed to observe has thus far never even been attempted by anyone in the so-called movement, not ever before. I want to provide us all with some kind of vision of our own post-revolutionary future as a white nation. Now, we need to see where we're going if we're ever going to get there. As well done and significant as the Turner Diaries is, its vision of the post-revolutionary Aryan future is sketchy at best. The book ends in a nuclear holocaust, not a reconstructed and revitalized world. We don't want to blow up the existing world. We want to make a new one for our people. I believe that these novels can fulfill their primary purpose, and that's giving the pioneers of the Northwest Independence Movement that sense of possibility I spoke of, not just a victory, but the possibility of a better world to come, if we're willing to pay the price for it here and now. I am letting you get a glimpse of the prize itself, letting you know that it exists, or it can exist, if we can find within ourselves the courage to change our thinking and to stiffen our spines. Now finally, and this is what makes everybody so nervous about me, I seek to remove the taboo on speech, a certain kind of speech, so as to prevent a taboo on a certain kind of thought. Direct action to end tyranny is like the word nigger. Politically correct society doesn't allow us to say nigger because it doesn't want us thinking nigger, and eventually people become so afraid of retaliation that they censor themselves from even thinking the word nigger for fear that they'll blurt it out, and that's what the regime wants. Direct action is the only thing that will bring about real change in this society. You either get that or you don't. And I think most of us do, down deep in the privacy of our own thoughts. We're just too terrified and paranoid to say it. I break that taboo, and like any time when someone breaks a taboo, it makes our more timid and conservative people nervous and uncomfortable. Well, hang on to your hats, guys, because the wildest ride is yet to come, because you know that world I describe in my Northwest novels, it's going to happen. Okay, maybe it won't happen exactly like I describe in the books, but something more or less like that world is coming right at you down the track like a runaway freight train. Now, you conservative folks out there have got two choices. Either jump on the Northwest train as it roars by, or leap the hell off the tracks. You need to make your choice now, because that train's getting closer by the second as we speak.
Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front, P.O. Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington, 98310. You can visit the party on our website at www.northwestfront.org. Until next week, comrades, hail victory.
Radio Area.com.